Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. This week, my old friend Jan Doolittle Wilson joins me to cover an Arya chapter. I need to apologize for the audio feed. I have two very legitimate excuses. This week is finals week, so I was doing a lot of final grading, oral exams, and whatnot. In addition to that, jury duty. Jury duty. I've never had it before. So you're basically getting the raw feed from Jan and my conversation. The quality is not necessarily to my liking, and I do apologize for that. In addition to that, because of my jury duty, this fantasy league I've been talking about on this podcast had to be postponed. And so life happened. Life happened this week. But I hope you enjoy this conversation with Jan. Nonetheless, I always enjoy talking with her. All right, without further ado, here is Dr. Jan Doolittle Wilson. So I've been thinking a lot about Oklahoma.
Yes. In what way, I should ask?
Well, for a lot of reasons, I've been thinking, this is sort of a lame thing to do to you because you're the only person I know in Oklahoma. But it's been on my mind a lot, and I'll tell you for two reasons. My wife just started Killers of the Flower Moon. I don't know if you're familiar.
Yes, everybody was very excited when they did filming here.
Yeah, so in sort of before the film comes out, and then she just started, and so then like she's almost finished, and I'm just beginning.
My husband has read it. I have not, I should
okay.
tell you.
All
so
right.
I can't really comment on the book. I just can tell you that, again, people here were very excited that, you know, Leo was here and Scorsese, and they did a lot of filming in some of the historic sections of downtown Tulsa and, you know, kind of in the larger, you know, area throughout, you know, this section of our state. So it's a very big deal here. And in fact, my daughter is an aspiring actress, singer, performer. And she had plans to maybe go down and be an extra on the film, but they had a lot of COVID protocols still in place.
Right.
And so they were being pretty selective about who they were letting on set. And so it didn't work out, but we're excited to see it.
So that was sort of the one of the things. And then the other thing is one of my absolute favorite shows of the last couple years is Reservoir Dogs.
Yes.
I just love that show. I watched it all, and then I rewatched it with my son, and I just am in absolute love with the characters in that show, and it's really kind of become one of my favorite shows of all time.
You know, again, my husband watches it. He is a you know, does history of the West, indigenous history. So he has watched all of it. I started the first season, really liked it, got busy, distracted with other things. So it's on my list to finish this summer. But the creator of the show, whose name is escaping me at this moment,
I think Starlin Harjo is, I don't know if I'm saying that correctly, but
Harjo is definitely the last name. The first name I think is close to that. But my husband met him.
Oh, excellent.
Nathan just very politely went up to him and said, I'm a huge fan. I love the show. And they had a really nice conversation. So he said he was just a really, really nice guy.
That's always good. And it doesn't always work out that way.
It doesn't always work out. But he was very pleasant and very appreciative of the compliments and, you know, said he was excited. I think they were launching the second season at that point. So
sure.
Just a really nice guy.
So
Oklahoma, you know, we have some notorious. We have some good things.
Absolutely. So anyway, it's just like it's like the confluence of these things that has Oklahoma on my mind.
Sure.
And of course. Okay. Let me do a quick sound. You're getting a little bit of Sibboleth on your end.
Okay. Do I need to adjust?
Maybe the mic. You're probably wearing the headset.
Yes.
Maybe move it down closer to your chin if that's possible. I think that that sometimes that helps and you don't have to mess with any of the audio settings.
Is that a little bit better?
Yeah. Yeah, that works.
Okay. Yeah, it was probably just up too high.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. I
Okay,
appreciate that.
great.
I maybe I could just jump right into maybe I could just jump right into my synopsis.
Okay, that sounds good.
Okay, so we're looking at Arya 5 here. Arya's companions have been reduced to a remnant, including Gendry, Hot Pie, Lommy, and Weasel. The group is starving near the war-ravaged God's Eye. Lommy wants to yield. Hot Pie refuses to eat worms. Gendry is trying to keep the children hidden, and Weasel continues to latch on to Arya. Arya recalls their narrow escape from the tower and being abandoned by Yoren's surviving recruits. After a debate on whether to approach a village, Gendry and Arya decide to get closer. Gendry is captured. Arya is determined to save him, but is betrayed by Hot Pie, who yields. After being concussed, she's only partially aware of what happens next. She, however, is alert enough to see Lommy murdered by one of Gregor Clegane's men. So, Jan, what shall we talk about today?
It's a rich chapter. There's a lot to discuss. When you were saying yield, of course, I was kind of chuckling, although that ends very badly for
Well,
Lommy.
there's a lot of talk about yielding in this
There is
chapter.
a lot. I mean, we could start there. I do have, some other things I want to
Yeah.
discuss, but well, it kind of relates actually to where I wanted to start, which is I was thinking so much about class and
Yeah.
the intersections of class and gender in this world, and how with a shift in politics, with a shift in leadership, with a shift in geography, the circumstance, one's position shifts so dramatically. And so, I think so much of Arya, whose chapters interestingly really parallel Sansa's in some really interesting ways.
Yeah.
They're both trying to navigate and negotiate this new relationship they both have to gender and class and the power dynamics, and now the lack of their father's protection. All of that's been stripped away, and they're placed in such different circumstances. They're both so vulnerable, but they're also trying to figure out the new rules and what does one have to do to survive. Everything I know is wrong. And so it's both of them relearning everything they need to know. All of the lessons from their father, a lot of those don't apply anymore. A lot of the lessons that they had absorbed from Septa, from their mother, all of that's gone. And what really strikes me in rereading this chapter, those who adhere to the old rules tend to be the ones who die. Those who can't adjust, those who still believe in honor and chivalry and the code. You see this with Yoren, who still have faith in that, they tend to be the first to go. And it's those who say, actually, the old codes don't apply, or we have to take those codes and manipulate them in this new world. And so when you said yield, I started thinking about how in the old world, maybe that would have worked. You yield. Your enemy doesn't kill you if you yield.
Yeah, or the idealized old world,
The
right?
idealized, but it's also again
Yeah.
tied to class, right? Because
Sure.
Mommy and Hot Pie, who have never been privileged, have this very romanticized view, I think, of what knights do and what soldiers do. I know this isn't in the book, but I did rewatch the couple of the episodes that correspond to this chapter. And something Hot Pie says in the show, which he again doesn't say in the book, but it really, I think, is relevant to this. Hot Pie, they're by the creek and they're getting water, and Hot Pie is talking about soldiers and armor, and he met a knight once. Do you remember this? And Arya says, "How do you know he was a knight?" Well, he wore armor, and he had a sword, and so they have this very kind of picture book idea, of what a soldier is supposed to be. And in the picture books and in the stories they've heard and the legends, you yield, and the person who is fighting you automatically allows you to surrender and treats you like a gentleman. And so they do think yielding will save them. Lommy keeps saying, all we have to do is yield. Hot Pie, all we have to do is yield. And poor Lommy, we know, how that turns out. He really thinks that they're wearing armor. They must be honorable. They are soldiers. They approach him And he says, I yield. You have to carry me now. And of
Yeah.
course, they kill him and laugh while they do it.
Yeah, it's an interesting bit of courtesy, right? It's like a rule of warfare, right? It's like, okay, here we, this is the way you fight honorably. And then, of course, when the fighting's done, we all sort of returned to our civilized, selves or something. But of course, in this world, there are no rules of warfare, right? The rules of warfare are the most powerful person probably will exploit or murder the weaker party. And so it's interesting that you say that. It's interesting when you started, you said something like the people that sort of adhere to the old rules end up going first, right? So Yorn would absolutely, be one of these, right? Because he was trying to do the honorable thing. He was trying to get Arya back up north. He was not, he felt like his cause was righteous.
And he's also a member of the Night's Watch, which, I mean, talk about codes and living by rules. And this is how you make sense of your world. You have these codes and you expect other people will abide by them. And that's a very Ned Stark thing, too. Yorin meets Ned. This is when Arya first encounters Yorin. She meets him in her father's study, and he's a man of the Night's Watch. And I was also just struck by, every place they go, they're going through these villages, and Yorin keeps telling Arya, "We're protected. We are neutral. We're not going to be attacked. We are the Night's Watch, and everybody knows that we are not political." Do you remember the scene where they or the chapter they go into the cornfield, and he says, "Everybody knows that the Night's Watch is allowed to forage in the fields. This is how we survive as we travel." And he is stopped.
they have to end up paying for these wormy apples that they've taken.
Yes, and he is so offended by that. He's maybe more offended by that than anything else they encounter, because this is not what one does. And I just again. That connection to Ned, Ned's world was full of these rules and these laws and these codes. And when Jeffrey took his head, all bets were off. All bets were off because Ned had sworn his pledge. He had signed the oath. He committed himself to being taken by the knights. In fact, Jorn was there to take Ned, and Joffrey had him beheaded, which was a huge violation of what was supposed to happen. So, I think it was very much in that moment that everything that used to kind of inform and organize this world is now just shattered.
So it's interesting that, I mean, there's a lot in this chapter to talk about, but I was just thinking the chapter that this follows is this interaction with Sansa and Ser Dantos. And he's almost using sort of these high fantasy courtesies to ally with her. She feels alienated. She's totally isolated. She's in a dark place. She's praying for a knight in shining armor. And Ser Danto shows up and he doesn't look like what she imagined, but he does remind her a little bit of Florian, right? So, and of course, he has all the right words to say. And, sort of my headcanon is he's been coached by Littlefinger, right? So, but he seemingly is playing by the rules of court. And the rules of court are very important to Sansa, right? So it almost your little, I guess your little rule for the road sort of works out because we know what happens to Dantos, right? Whether or not he thought he was actually doing the right thing by Sansa or whether he thought he was, saving his own skin, or maybe he's getting paid, or what? I don't know, but he sort of is the epitome of that. He looks like, someone who's going to try to be a good knight, and of course he's gonna die pretty quickly.
And he's also one of these kind of unlikely heroes too, that where both again, the parallels are so interesting because both Arya and Sansa, They each have their own agency. You know, I am a big defender of Sansa. I think Arya gets all the credit, but I think Sansa is very strong in her own right and learns to become even more so as we go through the books. But they have to find allies wherever they can. And those allies don't look anything like perhaps they thought they would, especially in Sansa's case. You know, a knight is not really a, you know, supposed to be that. A knight is chivalrous. A knight is treated, you know, treats others with honor, follows the code, is always noble. And, you know, she has to find, and even, you know, finding some kind of allyship with Baelish and, you know, people that she knows she can't fully trust, but has to use them somehow for her own survival. And I think it's an interesting parallel with Arya and Jaqen, which is also a fascinating relationship. You know, here you have a man who speaks honorably. I love the way he speaks, right? A man is thirsty. And how she is able to learn from him and find him extremely useful, who also doesn't really quite fit the old order in any way. You know,
Well,
he's
it's
not an
interesting.
example. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, finish what you're saying. It sort of leads me into another topic that I wanted to t discuss. Let's finish up this one though first.
Yeah, and he's a fascinating character. When she first meets him, he's in a cage. You know, he is in a cage. He has been taken out of, you know, the black cells, and he's on his way to the Night's Watch, and he's locked up with two other really vicious men.
They don't
And
have courtesy, but he
I
does,
mean,
right?
none, right? And so when he first speaks to Arya, you know, she's first, I think, taken aback because his tone is so different from the other two. And he even says to her, a man does not choose his company. He apologizes for the other two. And so he knows exactly what to say because he's so observant. He's been watching Arya. And so here is this man who is presumably a criminal who has to be locked up because he is so dangerous, according to Yoren. And yet he becomes one of her greatest allies. And in many ways, her protector in these first few chapters. And of course, goes on to have a bigger role later.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was, and those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
So it's interesting that you bring up Jock and Hagar, because you could say that Arya does the honorable thing with him.
Yes. Yes.
She does bring him water or beer or whatever. Yeah. She does bring him an axe to free himself, even though she doesn't totally trust him.
Right.
And eventually that event, I guess you could say eventually she's rewarded for doing the honorable thing. Right.
Yes.
So I think that there is something about, you know, you are in the middle of a war, which means that sort of chaos reigns and the rules don't apply. But you're in the midst of that. You kind of have to stay human however you can, right? So
yes,
you have to sort of pick your moments. And Arya does pick a moment or two. She picks one in this chapter. She wants to save Gendry, right?
Yes.
And sometimes she's rewarded for doing quote unquote the right thing, and sometimes she's not.
Right.
I think, and I mean, you could say this sort of generally about these books, is that sometimes doing the right thing will end up reaping dividends down the line.
Right.
And sometimes doing the right thing will get you killed.
I think it's such a good point, because I think maybe what, you know, Martin is trying to suggest is those who are inflexible in terms of, no, this is the code. This is how we live.
Yeah,
this
yeah.
is the honorable thing to do. They're going to die. But by the same token, also those who are completely merciless and exploit and take complete advantage of, we're living in this new chaotic order, I am going to be ruthless in the midst of this.
Yeah.
They also are not rewarded ultimately. They're punished in the end. And so I think it is those who, like Arya, like Sansa, who are very smart, right? Who know when the old rules simply don't apply and might get you killed, but also are retaining that core aspect of their humanity. So when she saves, you know, Jaqen, when she, you know, defends Micah, the butcher boy, you know, when she even, you know, in later chapters, her enemies list, you know, when she decides who will die, there's always some purpose to that. It's, you know, either to avenge a wrong, or it's self-defense, or, you know, she doesn't just kind of randomly kill. It's always for some larger purpose. And so I think you're right. The saving of Jaqen, really, there is no quid pro quo in her mind in that moment. It is not, I don't think she's consciously thinking at all, if I save this person, maybe he can help me. No, she sees that he will die. These men are going to burn to death. And at great risk to herself, she runs back into the burning building, choking on the smoke as she goes, and she hands them the axe. She didn't have to do that. There was really nothing in that for her. But it was that, you're right, it's that core piece of, this is the right thing to do. And that's, I think, what sets her apart. Even that conversation she has with Gendry, where, you know, poor Lami has been wounded, they're carrying him, Hot Pie is dragging them down, poor Hot Pie can't really fight. Weasel is pretty useless, she's a little girl.
Yeah.
And even Gendry is saying to Arya, let's just leave. They serve us no purpose, they'll get us killed. And Arya is the one who is saying, no, we cannot do that. And Arya is so much younger than Gendry.
Yeah. I feel like, in order to be fair to Gendry, he does kind of like...
I like Gendry. Let me just say I like Gendry.
I think he says, you know, it'd be better if Lami just died, because he's slowing us down.
He does. But I think doesn't he also suggest they should leave?
Yeah, right. I think he does say that, Okay, so maybe I retract this. He does say, I do think that he's trying the idea on Versailles.
Right.
I don't know if he will actually do it. I mean, he's the one that's been carrying Lamy most of the time, right?
Right.
I don't know if he'll actually do it. I think that he's sort of just stating a fact. And the fact that he's stating is, we would have a better chance to survive if we did what, who were the Cutjack and Tarber?
Yeah.
They just leave. And he's thinking, you know, that was kind of cruel what they did, but it was kind of the smart play because, you know, it's really hard to survive if you're trying to shepherd around a bunch of orphan boys, right?
Right.
And I think okay, so maybe I'm being a little overly Pollyannish on this. I wonder if Gendry is sort of saying, I don't know what the right thing to do is here. I'm going to say something out loud, which I think is factually true, and I'm just going to let it kind of hang there to see what happens with this.
And he's young, you know? I mean, he's young. They're all starving.
Oh, yeah.
They are exhausted.
Gendry's like 14 years old, right? So
yes, we forget how young he is. I mean, Arya's, what, not even 10 yet or had just turned 10? And
yeah.
They're little kids. And Lamy is not the easiest companion. and Weasel, poor thing, is
right?
crying constantly.
Yeah.
I mean, their nerves are shot at this point.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, I think it is, I can understand Gendry. They get a moment alone and he says, let's just go.
Okay.
Let's just keep going.
All right. And then also, it pains me to say this because I love Arya, but she does say at one point, her guise is up, right? He calls it out. You're a girl,
yes.
Right? And she knows that she can't say anything otherwise. All of the pretense is gone. And she, in her mind, she says, well, I either need to tell him the truth or kill him.
Or kill him.
And then she doesn't like state, you know, she doesn't like correct herself. She doesn't self-correct by saying something like, I don't know if that'd be the right thing to do. She self-corrects by saying, he is stronger than me. Maybe I wouldn't be able to kill him. So there's this part of her that feels like, to survive, I either need to trust him or kill him.
Yeah. There's that self-preservation piece,
yes.
Which I'm sure factors into Gendry's thinking we should just, you know, leave them behind. But I think with Arya, it's kind of more immediate, right? She does kill a couple mm-hmm. of people when she is faced with imminent threat.
Yeah.
And in that moment where Gendry kind of unmasks her and has known all along, that first thought is, okay, I have to defend myself against this person who's maybe a threat.
Mm-hmm.
But it also goes back to where we started, Anthony, because I just was chuckling as I read through this again, because it shows again how, you know, even Gendry, who is not highborn, he also adheres to the code. Because
I was
when
you about
she
that.
Says, I'm Arya Stark,
mm-hmm.
or I'm Arya of House Stark,
mm-hmm.
his entire demeanor changes and he starts calling her my lady.
Yeah, you
and
said.
Says, I'm even pissed in front of you. This is terrible. As if that matters in this world that she's, you know, of House Stark. That
right.
Doesn't matter at all. In fact, it's now a liability. It's
Absolutely.
Not something that will protect her.
Yeah, you mentioned when we started, there's an interesting intersection between gender and class, right?
Yes,
and
that's
so
kind
you,
of what I was thinking.
You kind of see that. I mean, there's a little. I'm trying to find a parallel with Sansa here, but for Arya's story, Gendry knows that she's useful and comparatively, right? Compared to the other wet rats that he has traveling with him. She, you know, she's resourceful. She's creative. She can be sneaky. She can climb a tree and, you know, spy and make, and she can make decisions, right? And she's
yes.
brave. And so he knows that there's more to her than meets the eye. He can, you know, he's not all to, she calls him stupid several times. He's not altogether stupid. He notices that she's a girl and he says, you're the only one that actually has any use to me, even though you're a girl, right?
Yeah.
So there's still kind of a hierarchy there because he's older. You know, that puts him above her. He's a male. That puts him above her. And then the tables completely turn, right, when she reveals that she's Arya of House Stark.
Right. Suddenly that means something different.
Now he feels like, oh, I've been saying the wrong things and I've been talking about my cock and I should call you my lady.
It's such a good point, Anthony. Yes, right. So before, you're right, gender in this world, as long as she can fight, and wow, she proved herself with that sword, you know, in the previous chapter. He knows she can fight. She can, she's quiet. She can climb the tree. She can spy on people. She's very good at that. And so he doesn't care that she's a girl, but suddenly she's a girl and a Stark.
Yes.
And that's what causes the shift.
Yeah.
And so again, even she's the same person she was 2 minutes ago, but suddenly with that Stark name attached, he treats her differently. And it's an interesting, I keep using the word parallel, but if you think back to, do you remember that scene in Game of Thrones? I keep saying scene, chapter in Game of Thrones, where Arya gets locked out of the castle and she has to try to get back through the gate.
Yeah.
And they call her little urchin boy, or, you know, this little poor kid, get away. And she says so forcefully, I am not a boy. I am a girl, and I am the daughter of the Hand of the King. And so she knows when to invoke her class privilege. She knows when to invoke her gender. How dare you call me? And she gets offended when Yoren calls her a boy the first time. So she's very forceful about, I'm a girl and I'm a Stark. The two very things that in a clash of kings will get her killed or will get her captured and leave her vulnerable. So those things that protected her before, the things that she claimed before, she has to hide. It's so interesting. And again, if you think about what Sansa has to do, Sansa still has her name, and she does have her privileges of class and gender. There are several times Joffrey says, I can't treat you badly because you're a girl. You're going to be my wife, even though he has his knights do it on his behalf. But there is that insulation, you know, that she has. The very things that, again, do not insulate Arya in that very different setting. Although, of course, they're both very vulnerable. They're both highly at risk. And I wanted to ask you, who do you think is more at risk? Who is more vulnerable, or are they just vulnerable in different ways?
I mean, I think I was going to, if you were to ask me two chapters ago, I would say that at least Arya has Yoren.
Yeah.
And, you know, Yoren is he's an adult and he has a purpose, and at least he'll find, you know, he's done this trip several times, right? So he's not in uncharted waters, and he cares about getting her back to Winterfell. And here Sansa is, she's totally isolated, like,
and doesn't know who to trust.
She's abused, she's being physically beaten. And I think that now Arya is in the worst shape, and even
now that Yoren's gone.
I think that Sansa now has a new ally, and that's the Hound. Even though she doesn't realize it yet, she thinks that Dantos is her ally. It's really the Hound. Because the Hound is the only one that will not obey Joffrey if Joffrey, you know, says, commands something.
Right.
I mean, you could probably say the same thing about Tyrion, but I don't think Sansa's even on Tyrion's radar very much.
Another unlikely hero, the Hound.
Yes,
right?
That's
another
right.
One of those things she never would have imagined when she first met the Hound, that this would be a person who would be a protector of sorts, someone that she could trust. And then, of course, we have the Arya and Hound relationship later, which is also interesting.
Why do you think Weasel latches on to Arya in the way that she does? She doesn't latch on to, like, it's not like Arya's like
much kinder to her.
Much kinder than the others. But she's really kind of, she almost has separation anxiety with Arya. She's sort of chosen Arya as her, you know, big sister / mother / whatever.
I don't know. It could be that Arya's the smallest. She's maybe the least threatening. She probably has seen the moments of, you know, compassion that Arya has shown to other people. Maybe she kind of senses that Arya is a girl that maybe has more in common with her. it's hard to tell. You know, Weasel's a character who doesn't speak, just cries. She's just
Yeah.
a very sad. It's very sad, her story. I'd like to, do we ever encounter her again? I
In
can't remember.
fact, we don't. And I was going to ask you
Okay.
about that because, you know, Martin's stories are known for, or at least they have the reputation for being hyper-realistic.
Right.
And I think that that might be true if you're comparing it with like high fantasy or something, but Martin does have rules for storytelling. And one of the rules that he likes to adhere to is that a character will often receive just desserts.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Jamie pushes Bran out the window with a hand, he loses a hand.
Yeah.
You know, Theon is horrible, horrible to the women around him. He's almost a sexual predator, right?
Right.
In this book, you really see that. And then, of course, we know what Theon loses.
Right.
And, you know, like the slavers that Dany encounters, they end up getting burnt. And you can just kind of go down a list of like the kinds of people who commit a particular kind of sin. There's almost like a counterbalance. It's almost a Catholic, you know, sort of counterbalance for like sin and penance or something.
Right.
And I wonder if, because Arya has shown kindness to Weasel, whether maybe we haven't seen the last of Weasel. Like if just desserts are sometimes a mainstay of his storytelling, is it possible that as the story progresses, Arya will be in a situation where she needs someone to show her kindness, and Weasel is there to do it?
I like that. I would love if we if she made a reappearance in the last couple of books. And of course, Arya takes on her name too, which might show that there is some sort of, reconnection that might happen later. Does it I don't this is really off the top of my head. I haven't thought this through, but does it sort of remind you of the relationship Arya has with Nymeria?
Yes,
Right, in
I
order to
was
save
thinking
Nymeria,
that.
she pushes Nymeria away, and kind of is what happens with Weasel. Run as fast as you can, even though, I'm going to be sad maybe without you. I want to protect you, so go.
No, I do. I got the same sense. I got the same, like, eventually I feel like that connection with Nymeria has to pay off in some way.
Right.
And I wonder if there's something similar that's going to be hap that's going to happen with Weasel as well.
It almost seems inevitable now that you're making all of those connections. It just makes a lot of sense, and it seems consistent, with what Martin does.
Now, I probably should add a bit of a caveat here. I do think that there are characters like Yoren or like Ned or whatever, and they try to do the right thing and they end up dying because of it. And that sort of brings us back to an earlier conversation.
Right. Which is also kind of a Martin rule, right? You
Sure.
can't just abide by the old. You have to adapt or you die.
I think that there's something about the way that Martin likes to tell these stories is that, and I've heard him say this, which is, I think, both a virtue and a vice, but he says, if I introduce a character and they're part of the story, I would like to see that character have a good beginning, a significant middle, and a fitting end. Like he cares about the story arcs of these characters.
Yeah.
And so, you know, here's Yoren. You know, we see him over the course of, you know, the last part of the first book and the first part of the second book, and he's kind of run his course. And it's possible that Yoren, it was, you know, he was sort of a prop for Arya.
Yeah.
And that's fine. That's sort of, that was his story arc and he runs his course, but he does have a legitimate beginning, middle, and end of his story. And I think that you could, on top of that, what you could say is because he does care about these characters in that way, a device he'll often use is that there's the sort of a just desserts aspect of characters that he likes to use. And maybe he doesn't always use it, But that is sort of a device that he likes to use.
I think that's true. You made me think of the other side of that. Maybe this is where you're going. You know, we've kind of established that in most instances, characters like Yoren or Ned, those who follow the rules and live by a code, usually will die. Mm-hmm. Is it also true that those who violate the code in the most egregious ways will end up being punished? And I'm thinking Joffrey, but I'm also thinking of Walder Frey, who you and I have talked about. Mm-hmm. He violated one of the most sacred codes you can violate. Mm-hmm. And we know what ends up happening to Walder Frey. So I'm trying to think of other examples, but it also seems like Martin likes to carry that, to follow that through.
Yeah.
Yes, while honorable men may be punished for not adapting to a new order, he will also punish those who violate that order.
Well, I was thinking about Jon Snow because, you know, he takes this oath and sort of the core collective identity of the Night's Watch is to defend against the darkness. But the way that that's interpreted and the way it has been interpreted for thousands of years is, we do not let the wildlings past us.
Yes.
The wildlings do not get past the wall. Now that's sort of core to that collective identity. And of course, he takes the vow, and that's what he thinks he's vowing. And then he ends up reinterpreting the vow and violating that code.
Right.
He ends up getting punished.
Right, which is also a violation of the code, right? You don't kill your brothers.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I feel like I should probably say that whenever we sort of discover a rule about Martin's story, then there's always the possibility that it's going to get subverted, you know?
Right. And who subverts it and why?
Uh-huh.
I think that's interesting too. And you mentioned John. Could we also say, we need to write all of this down, Anthony. Could we also say that those who subvert the rules are usually, it's valid when they do so because they are doing it for non-selfish reasons.
Hmm.
And so it's not like John is building an army to empower himself and take over King's Landing, right? He's doing it, what he thinks he's doing it for protection.
Hmm.
And so maybe that's the difference. Whereas we know that somebody like Joffrey and Frey are just all out for themselves. That's why they're violating the code.
Here's the thing that struck me as I reading this. I was just thinking, this is what war looks like. It is not glory. It's not painting yourself with honor. You know, this is not a song. This is what war really looks like. This is being desperate and eating worms and hiding, yeah, you know, hiding from, you know, these knights that you think that will protect you and being disappointed by these so-called men of honor. I mean, that is Martin. This is the story that Martin's telling in this book.
Yeah.
That you hear about these great battles but what would it be like to be a 9-year-old girl in trying to, you know, forage for food in the aftermath of the battle?
I think you're right. And he's also doing this through the eyes of the child. You know, Arya has, I think, don't quote me on this, but I think other than Tyrion has the most point of view chapters in the book, or at least an equal number. And so we see so much of this story through Arya, and that is even more impactful because here you have this 9-10 year old little girl who is watching people being slaughtered, right? She is passing under corpses that have their entrails are hanging out. Their limbs have been hacked off. She witnesses the torture, you know, from the Tickler, which I think you're right with from Martin's point of view, it just shows this kind of banality of evil idea.
Yes.
Because Arya says at one point, this guy was just in the canteen. I don't think she calls it a canteen, but he just looks like a normal guy. I thought evil looked evil.
Yeah.
And here's just this guy who's having conversations with people, having a snack. And then an hour later, he's torturing people.
Mm-hmm.
So he, you know, I do think absolutely that's what he's trying to show is war is horrific. And seeing it through the eyes of a child who has already experienced so much trauma makes it even worse.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
So the other thing I wanted to kind of call out here, and it sort of reminds us that we're sort of in a fantasy novel, right? Is this paragraph. I'll just read this paragraph. Arya's arms and legs were stiff when she finally wriggled out from under the briar into the dark of the wood. It was a black night with a thin silver moon appearing and disappearing as the clouds blew past, silent as a shadow, she told herself as she moved through the trees. In this darkness, she dared not run for fear of tripping on some unseen root or losing her way. On her left, the God's Eye lapped calmly against its shores. On her right, a wind sighed through the branches, and leaves rustled and stirred. Far off, she heard a howling of wolves. So those last couple lines are interesting.
You have such a nice reading voice, Anthony, by the way.
Thank you.
It's very soothing.
Martin has this little trick that he does with wind in trees. I think for him, that's sort of code for something spiritual is happening or something right. Supernatural is happening. She's near the God's Eye, which is sort of one of the most sacred places for the religion of the North, right?
Right.
Even though she's in the South, it's supposed to be a sacred place. And then, of course, there's wolves howling. So it's like on her left, there's the God's Eye, sacred. The wind's blowing through the trees to the right, sacred. And then she hears wolves howling in the distance, sacred. And I feel like after sort of being a close reader of Martin's text, that is sort of his way of reminding us that there's more at work here than meets the eye.
Right.
But he'll do that in ways where it's not immediately obvious that something supernatural is happening. And in all of those ways, you could say, yeah, well, just on the face of it, you know, waves lap and wind blows and wolves howl. What's the big deal? But when you put all of those things together, it really is Martin's way of talking about spirituality.
Oh, yeah.
And so you have this little, you know, this little reminder about Arya's supernatural ability when she comes back to Lami and Weasel. They start and they say, yes. we thought you were a wolf.
Yes.
Right. And then she is a wolf. Right.
So she has the blood of the wolf. Right. That again, that blood connection and that family heritage, and so much we could unpack there. Mm. But I'm reminded of a couple of things, just how often she has Sirio in her head in these chapters.
Yes.
And she repeats those lines again and again and again. And, you know, quiet as the wind, or, you know, quiet as the wolf, or use your eyes, use your ears, use all of your senses. And that saves her many, many times. Mm-hmm. But it's also, I think you're right, this fantasy element where she clearly is channeling something and connecting to something, even if she doesn't quite realize it. Because the Starks, they have these abilities. And so, you know, she starts seeing through Nymeria's mm-hmm. point of view.
Mm-hmm.
She is connecting to Nymeria, even though Nymeria is not in close proximity. And I know this isn't a later chapter, so you may not want to talk about this, but her conversation with Ned, I think, is interesting too. Is she just kind of dreaming of Ned when he kind of, you know, comes to her and says, you have to survive, you're a Stark, you've got, you know, the blood of the wolf.
Mm.
The lone wolf dies, but the pack survives, mm-hmm. which is such a running theme in terms of how she conducts herself. And, you know, this idea that it is kind of the lone people who stake out their own claim who often don't survive, but it's those who band together, particularly if they're considered weaker. You know, together we are strong. But she has this conversation with Ned. And is she actually talking to Ned?
Mm.
Is she envisioning Ned? You know, we know that... Rickon, for example, sees Ned on the night Ned dies. So I'm wondering if you think she's actually able to communicate with Ned as like a spirit, or is she just imagining what he would say to her?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to read these things as supernatural, right? I feel like if they're placed there, they're placed there on purpose.
Yeah.
Like I think that Martin is very purposeful on these things. And yet he does these things vaguely enough that it's open for interpretation.
Which I love, right? He doesn't kind of hit the reader over the head with this is what it means.
Yeah.
That those subtleties of, like you said, the wind and the sounds, and, you know, we're really in, I think, Arya's mindset as she's running back mm-hmm. to the camp. Mm-hmm. We hear what she hears. We see what she sees. We experience what she experiences. And that's good writing.
Yeah, and it's not like he's uninterested in psychology. I mean, you could read all of these things as sort of a psychological device, right, to tell a mm-hmm. story about the character's makeup.
And how one deals with trauma.
Yes.
You know, the idea of hauntology and communicating with ghosts.
Yeah.
And connecting to those who have been, especially those who have died violently or been taken from you unexpectedly. And again, we forget how young these characters are.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, she is so young, and she's not only so young, she and Sansa, this is another way that connects them. They both witness Ned die, even though Arya doesn't directly look mm-hmm. at what's happening. Mm-hmm. She's right there. And Sansa does see it happen. And so again, the parallel between these two sisters, even though they're very different in personality.
Yeah.
And their situations are different. They both have the tools, and they develop the tools and skills they need. And they're smart. They're both very smart because they watch and they listen.
Yeah.
And they observe and they learn. And that's how they make it out.
It's interesting with Arya because, you know, it was so amazing to me that she didn't actually see Ned die. But when she's talking with Jorn in a previous chapter, she keeps seeing it happen.
Yeah.
And Jorn's like, you couldn't have seen it.
Yeah,
and yet she feels like she did. Yes. And yet that's what she sees in her, you know, she's afraid to sleep because that's what she'll see in her dreams. And so it's not, she didn't witness it, you know, with her eyes, but she's seen it how many times in her dreams, right? So, she's haunted by it nonetheless. I do feel like there's something about, like, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with someone that said, no, this is her her encounter with Ned is not sort of a ghost or something like that. It's not any kind of an ability. This is just her processing.
Yeah.
And that would, you know, that's Shakespeare. That's the hero's journey. That's Freud. You know, there's a lot of ways that you can read that in a literary way that would absolutely make sense.
Yeah.
So I think that there's multiple ways to look at it.
And the hero's journey is interesting too. If you think about, you know, typically the mentor has to die so the hero can grow. But this keeps occurring to Arya. It's not just one mentor that she loses. She keeps losing them as she goes through. But she learns from every single one of them to enable her to, you know, do what she's able to do through all of these different journeys that she has. So that's an interesting way to look at it too. But you're right. I think either way, I'm content with interpreting that either way.
I feel like Arya's story is the hero's spiral.
Yes.
At least so far, the circle doesn't seem to be flat in Arya's case. So.
And how she, you know, her motivations, I love how she's varied in her motivations as well. She doesn't just have this singular drive for revenge. You know, she doesn't have this singular drive for survival. It's all of those things. And so if you look at the different people she kills, and especially early on, she feels bad that she's killed them. You know, she thinks back to the first boy in the stable and is kind of, I don't know if ashamed is the right word. Maybe just feels a little guilty about that, that she doesn't even tell Yoren. You know, how will Yoren react to the knowledge that I killed somebody as I was trying to escape, even though I think Yoren would probably understand that it was just pure self-defense. And then, you know, the other people that she decides are worthy of death or deserve death for whatever reason. You know, her enemies list gets longer and longer. So she's just, it's a really interesting character. Who makes up that list and why? Why are they on her list? For what reason? And I think those reasons vary somewhat, but in her mind, they all definitely deserve to die.
So that kind of brings us to Lami's fate, right?
Poor Lami. He really thought they were going to carry him, didn't they? Or didn't he? I mean, he just was, you got to carry me. Like, it wasn't even a question.
So, oh goodness. So he really, I mean, look, he's wounded. He's dying. Like, I think that's probably what Gendry says about him is true. It's like that wound has festered. He probably doesn't have long for it. You know, he tells him like, look, if they have leg potion, we'll bring back some leg potion or whatever.
Right. You know, and Arya, I think, even wants to take him to a maester. Let's find a maester out here in the wilderness. Or maybe Gendry's. I forget which one of them suggests. Let's just find a maester. But I thought, no.
No, it is. It is Arya. It's one of the few.
Is it Arya?
There's a couple of places in this chapter where she almost choreographs her class difference.
Yeah.
She says, at one point, she says, look, if you're going to hunt a boar, you need a hunting party. And a boar spear and men, you know, and horses. And, you know, she like, you know, she sort of reels off this sort of royal hunt. Right. And then she says that to, you know, to Gendry about the maester. She's like, we got to get him to a maester. And Gendry's like, what are you talking about? Maesters are in castles.
That's right. Yeah. I think you're so right about that.
So, but she does, she absolutely does that. And then of course, I do think that there's something about the book you really get the sense that they've been dragging Lami and carrying Lami for several miles, right?
Yes.
So that doesn't happen in the show. And so in the book, it almost is a little bit of a instruction to the reader about how much danger Bran is going to be in.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, if he is without the ability to walk up in the north, his life is absolutely expendable.
Right.
And so his protectors are absolutely going to be paramount. And so I think that there's something about Lami's story that is almost a cautionary tale that sort of raises the stakes for Bran's story up north.
It does. And I think it, in the book, because they have carried him around for so long, they have done everything they can to preserve him, even though Arya and Gendry know he's probably going to die. You know, you mentioned the infected leg. They can smell the infection. He is going to die. And yet they still cart him around rather than just abandon him, leave him in the woods. And none of that matters again when the soldiers come and they just dispatch him immediately. And it also makes me, it reminds me of Tyrion. You know, we live in a world where if you have any, what was considered a flaw or a disability, you are expendable. You are no longer valuable to this society. And it's only Tyrion's class position that saves him. He says this again and again and again. If I were not a Lannister, they would have left me in the woods.
Yeah.
Bran, when he falls from the tower, rather when he's pushed from the tower, if he had been in a, you know, lower class family, they probably would have abandoned him or killed him. He would no longer be useful. But Bran is protected because of class. But yet when Winterfell falls and he leaves that environment and they're trying to, you know, escape or go up north, he is in a much more vulnerable position where he's going to rely on people who are also vulnerable, right? Who don't have protections of class, who are going to be in a position where maybe if they are attacked, okay, it doesn't matter that this kid is Bran Stark. We're getting out of here. We're going to save ourselves. It's a very, very different environment that he enters.
Yeah, it's, I guess it reminds you that there's almost this brutish mentality of the survivalist that sort of starts to think about very, very basic needs, right?
Right.
And so, yeah, so that's the way this book ends. This book ends with Bran, you know, beginning his journey north, and and that's the culture where he's heading into, sort of this situation where it's going to be all survival all the time, and anyone he encounters along the way will be a sort of brutal survivalist.
Yeah,
and so
it is a survivalist tale in many ways.
Yes, yeah, for sure.
And what would you do? You know, what would you do to survive? What lengths would you go to? What choices would you make? I'm watching Yellow Jackets right now, so I very much have this on my brain about, you know, being placed in desperate circumstances and what that does. Almost like this instinctual, you know, force takes over in some ways where, you know, the body has this will to survive. The mind has this will to survive. And, you know, sometimes horrible choices are made. And how do you hang on to your humanity in that kind of environment?
So he really is sort of this creature of circumstance. He's done nothing, you know, we were talking about just desserts earlier. He's done nothing to really deserve the situation that he's in. And if, I guess what this is meant to teach us is that, you know, Arya needs to become acquainted with death. And there are many, many ways to die. And this is one of the lessons she has to learn along the way. So I almost feel like Lammy is one of these characters that is sort of there in the story to teach Arya a lesson.
And I think one of her biggest lessons is the senselessness of it all. There, you know, there's this passage where a lot of the villagers that they encounter keep saying, "Why are you doing this? We have not raised arms against you. We have not rebelled. We are just living our lives as we always have, and you are killing us. Why would you do this?" And, you know, the Tickler again, just again, this banality, you know, again, the mountain who makes promises to this mother and then kills the daughter anyway. There are no rules and there is no purpose, really.
Or Armory Lorch. He's basically, he just looks completely bored by the entire thing.
Just bored by it.
But he's commanding everything to be burned.
That's not what they tell you in the stories. There has to be a purpose. And when you kill people, they're your enemy. And, you know, you must have done something to deserve it. And that's not what's happening at all. How do you survive in that world when there are no rules? If I do this, I will survive because I'm not going to rebel. If I yield, they won't kill me. You know, if I show loyalty to you, you know, there's so many examples of the prisoners, praising the Lannisters. You know, that means that they'll see that we're loyal and they'll save us. No, they get killed too.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do to survive? It reminds me of they're all in the holding pen. Who gets picked out to be tortured that day? People who hide in the corner, they get picked. People who, again, you know, say that they're loyal, they get picked. There's nothing you can
There's
do.
There's no rhyme or
it's
reason.
It's just so random.
War is,
and I think
yeah,
that's maybe the
chaos.
Biggest lesson. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, so I think that there's something about Lami's story that parallels Arya's story. And so you almost get this sense that this could happen to Arya at any point, of course.
Right, at so, any point.
Yeah, so I think it sort of raises the stakes for her. I'm going to say notable departures, but I do have one more thing I want to ask you about.
Okay.
So notable departures, we finally, I guess, I'm going to say yes to Yoren's death. There's a sense in which, you know, his clothes, his hair, they're all convinced that he's dead, right?
Yeah.
So seemingly Yorn's gone. I always take these things with a tiny grain of salt, right?
Like, I'm always wondering, is Syrio really dead?
That's right. That's right.
I'm always telling my kids the number one rule: if you don't see a body,
you didn't
they're
see
not
them
dead.
Die on screen. And sometimes even when you do see them, die
sometimes even when you do, right. But especially if you don't see the body.
So Lami, we talked about, Kurtz dies, Cutjack and Tarbor abandon them.
Right. Who knows? They're probably dead too, I'm assuming.
And then Weasel leaves the story never to return, as far as we know.
Right.
So let me ask you this question, because like I said, this is a fantasy story. So every now and again, my mind wanders. They're crawling back to save Gendry. And Hot Pie is crawling along, you know, trying to be as quiet as he can. And a crow attacks him.
Yeah.
Maybe thinking he's a dead body or something. I don't know what the crow's thinking, but I keep thinking, okay, there's an animal in the story. It's a crow. We've been given hints already that they're super, you know, they're in a supernatural place and supernatural things are happening. I wonder if there's some kind of wargish intent behind the crow here, or whether it's just dumb luck.
Yeah, again, I thought of that too, because Martin is rarely unintentional.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the fact that it's a crow, and we know how important crows are, I don't know. It's interesting. And who would be kind of warging, and whose intent? Would it be, it's interesting to think that maybe like a brand situation where maybe like somebody who is on their side wants them to be captured in that moment, because if they're not, something worse might happen.
Yeah. That's the only thing I can
think.
It's an
intervention, you know, I thought of that too.
So there's a parallel here. Oh, go ahead.
Well, there are a few other places where I know that some readers have speculated Bran is going into the past and is intervening in Arya's story as a form of protection, as well as Jon's story.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Bran. I think that the parallel is that when Jon tries to run, to abandon his watch and go join up with Rob, Ghost ends up, you know, he's hiding. His brothers are looking for him. And Ghost ends up giving his location away.
Right.
And so that kind of made me think, what's going on here?
Yeah.
When would we ever see Ghost betray Jon, right?
Right. We know that Bran can control, you know, wolves.
Yes.
He can inhabit crows. I mean, he can do all of that. So
yeah.
It would be fascinating to me if that comes back. And again, in the later books where we see that all along, it was, you know, Bran intervening at these crucial times.
Or, I mean, I guess another way to look at it is it's like Blood Raven and he's trying to do naughty things.
Right. It could be either way.
I don't know. Like, all this is kind of speculation, but
it's more interesting to kind of think about, actually, this had to happen here, because if they had kept going, they would have been killed. And so there's this larger picture that, you know, somebody out there can see. Who's kind of making these choices that seem to be things that are working against the heroes in the moment, but perhaps are not.
Yeah. And I think that there's something, I mean, look, This is the kind of story where you're supposed to ask those kinds of questions, right?
Yes. And it's fun to ask those questions. I get irritated when people say, oh, you're reading too much into it. Uh-huh. That's the point. That's part of the fun. Speculating and thinking about what these things mean and talking to other people who love these stories.
I sort of ride that fence because sometimes I think the text is there's something about the text that is sacred. It's like, there's something about this text that is telling me a story. I should go with the text. I should just go where the text wants to take me instead of trying to impose things onto the text. And then I also feel like you do, like, but where's the fun in that? You know?
Right. Well, I kind of am more of a middle ground too, to tell you the truth. I certainly don't criticize anybody for, you know, kind of imposing their own meanings on the text and mm-hmm. making of characters what they will. If that serves a purpose for them, that's fine. But, you know, you and I have spent 15 minutes or more on this pod talking about the rules of Martin. You know, what are the rules for? And that's mm-hmm. fun to me, too, to kind of trace. Here are the patterns that are being laid out for us.
Right. It's about
here
patterns,
are the things that
really,
the author
right?
is hinting at. Yeah. Let's use our imagination within those parameters, because I'm not a huge fan of going too far off text. But when we get clues, I think we can run with it, right? When Martin presents us with the crow, I think it's perfectly valid to say, what does the crow mean? He gave us a crow. We think
he could have chosen anything. He
could have chosen anything.
It could have been a field mouse.
He gave us a crow.
Yeah, that's right.
Just like the red comet, it means something, right?
Yes. Yeah. And yes. So I'll just put it out as a question. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily need an answer, but I was asking myself, is there something behind, is there a human intention behind the actions of the crow? I don't know what to do with that question, but it is Martin. It is a supernatural, book, and we do have supernatural clues just in this chapter alone.
And it is a crow.
And it is a crow, so yes.
I am right there with you. Okay. I had the same question.
And now Throwback Thursday with comic Steve Osborne.
The action sequence that happens, you know, on the road to the wall, essentially, is it does feel inevitable. There's nothing about it that seems terribly surprising. It's dramatic.
Well, we have the... a medieval Bill Burr character killing Lami. So Lami's dead.
Yeah.
Poor Lami.
Poor Lami.
It was right through the throat. I mean, he was just getting his sort of adult vocal cords.
Yeah.
That squeaky little junior high voice one. Just got clipped.
Yeah. Yeah, that was pretty. And it was done with the needle, too. It was even...
Yeah. So that character is medieval Bill Burr. That character's name is Polliver.
Okay.
And in the book, it's a guy named Raff. And I don't know.
It would be so much more interesting if it was Bill Burr as Bill Burr.
It was actually Bill Burr.
Like he puts the knife through the throat and is like, brutal! Ah, what a mess! Ass blood everywhere! It's gross!